From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a climate scientist wrote a thread about how challenging it will be to stop using oil, to end our usage of fossil fuels at a wide scale, to actually do it. After all, climate scientists generally agree that getting off oil is a requirement if we want to mitigate potentially catastrophic climate change. And in theory, it sounds rather simple, just change systems. In practice, it is doable. It has big hurdles, too. Catherine Hayhoe is the director of the Texas Tech University Climate Science Center, and I want to quote some of her thread. This is kind of long, but it's part of the reason we're here, so let me go ahead and quote what she had to write recently. Quote, "Why is it so hard to wean ourselves off fossil fuels in time to prevent serious impacts from climate change? Well, it'd be nice if there were just one reason, but there isn't. First, some economic reasons. Fossil fuels are woven through our entire global economy, and 7/10 of the richest corporations in the world depend intimately on fossil fuels for their success, so they have every reason to preserve the status quo. Then political reasons. Money equals campaign donations equals power. Plus, Republicans oppose so-called big government, and climate solutions are typically presented as such. Then there's Citizens United, gerrymandering, many other factors that also play a role in preventing change. Some cultural reasons. Climate solutions require acting together. Yet culturally, the U.S. is one of the most independent countries in the world. Also, there is an active disinformation campaign. Then there's the fact that we as humans are pretty good at immediate threats, but generally terrible at long-term challenges. We already don't save enough to retire or eat what we should. Well, what's more long-term than climate change? This is why just telling them the scientific facts will not change too many minds. The lack of scientific understanding did not even make my list. The bottom line, we need to connect the dots between climate change and what people already care about." End quote. I was moved by this climate scientist thread. It did not make me pessimistic. It simply clarified the challenges, and I thought it would be valuable to invite a panel to discuss those challenges. I reached out to climate professionals, policy advisors, academics, and also concerned citizens who have spent many hours on these related issues. And my guests for the hour include Suzanne Hunt, founder of Hunt Green LLC and director of strategic development at Hunt Country Vineyards in the Finger Lakes. Suzanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Sue Hughes-Smith, co-founder of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Sue, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
Tim McGowan is the founding member of the Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester. Tim, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan. Good to see you.
And Eric Hittinger is an associate professor of public policy at RIT. Welcome back to you, Eric.
Great. Thanks to be back.
It's a long list, and I want to ask all of you, I'll start with Suzanne Hunt, what stands out most to you on her list? And then, you know, sort of how viable is the solution to what stands out to you on her list? What did you think, Suzanne?
Well, having spent well over a decade in Washington, the money equals campaign donations equals power is certainly the one that stands out for me. It's if I had to pick one of the biggest barriers, that's it.
But that seems intractable to people. Right now, money as a wielding influence of power in Washington in politics feels pretty significant and entrenched.
Yeah, I mean, it's really common for members of Congress off the record to say that, you know, they get the science. They're smart people. They are worried about the future. They're concerned for their children, their grandchildren. But they know that if they take action on climate change, that the oil and gas interests will come and put millions of dollars into making sure that they lose their next election.
They will tell you that off the record.
Absolutely. It's very common.
It's happened many times for you?
Absolutely.
And then when they fear that big money is coming into campaigns, is that sort of the boogeyman that doesn't come, or you've seen that kind of influence in terms of money show up and impact elections?
Oh, yeah. And it's not just money. I mean, active manpower to go out and recruit candidates to run to do the bidding of the fossil fuel interests.
Okay. Let's go around the table. Tim McGowan, what stood out to you from her list?
Well, a couple things, Evan. The first thing was in regard to the corporate involvement and funding, as we're talking about, one of the things I'm aware of is that Exxon, for instance, from early on, acknowledged there was going to be a price on carbon at some point. And just recently, they issued a press release in which they're really focusing now on making more efficient their chemical manufacturing process, and also putting some targeted limits on methane production and flaring up. So, at any rate, they're actually involved at the same time that they're putting lots of money into
political campaigns.
Yeah, political campaigns. So, but the other thing that struck me about the corporate thing was the fact that just last week the Pope announced the fact that he would be convening the CEOs of the major oil companies globally to talk about climate change. So then there's the moral dimension of it all. But that's an agent, and that's a process in terms of, you know, look at we're looking at a species and an earth generating energy here. What are we going to do, and what's your responsibility? So those are two encouraging things to me, just on the corporate piece.
Okay, Sue Hughes-Smith.
There was so much in her comments. It's hard to pick just one thing, but I think the politicalization, I can't say that word, of environmentalism in particular, but climate as well, it shouldn't be, survival of our species shouldn't really be a political issue. And when you're not willing to deal with that basic fact and then work together to come up with a solution that works for everybody, I think that's a huge challenge. Instead, people are using people's preconceived beliefs, whether they're religious or political, to maintain their own biases or power dynamics. I think that's a huge challenge for us.
Okay, Professor Hettinger.
Yeah, I think one of the things that she's saying in the tweet thread in general is that it's a new kind of problem. It's a problem we haven't dealt with in the past. Generally, we're good at dealing with problems that have a low amount of resources at stake, something that we can solve in a few years to decades, and things that affect us locally. But climate change obviously pushes the bounds in all three of those dimensions. And so our traditional policy approaches and tools and organization strategies don't really apply here. Now, that doesn't mean we can't solve the problem. It does mean, though, that we need to come up with new ways to think about the problem, to organize around it and address it. And so developing those new tools is something we have to do in parallel to all the actions that we're taking.
Yeah, I noticed she did not say in the thread, look, do you know how many gas stations there are? It's going to be impossible. She didn't say that. And I'm struck by a couple of things. Number one, Suzanne Hunt, when we look at the actual infrastructure, yeah, I think the Exxons and big oil and gas are going to argue we have the infrastructure in place and for fossil fuels, but a massive change would be too difficult. And earlier this morning, we had a little conversation, and you brought up a really interesting example to me, because in the past, the way I've thought about it was, well, and this is what Adam Frank said to me a couple of years ago, in 1890, we didn't have gas stations, and in 1920, 1930, they were on every corner. We made a big change in three or four decades because we wanted to. We can make this change. You directed me to a different example and an even more limited timescale about significant structural change.
Yeah, so the example we were talking about was switching from landline telephones to cell phones. When the cell phone was invented, no one sat around and said, oh gosh, it's going to be so hard. How do we build a global infrastructure of cell towers and manufacturing?
And satellites in space?
And we're going to have to change cultural norms and put satellites up into space. And there's going to be all this resistance to these ugly cell phone towers. No one said that. People saw this huge value proposition, and they went out and innovated, and within a decade, most of the world has access to cell phones. And if we put a long-term stable policy environment in place, you will see that same level and speed of entrepreneurial activity around transitioning off of fossil fuels.
So a decade or less, and that is such a good example. So we can do this, but you know, Tim points to the Pope, I think very well-intended, bringing these CEOs together. And I don't want to ever speak for Pope Francis or any Pope, but I imagine he's going to lean on them to really think about the impact of what they're doing and what their companies are doing. But here's another thing Suzanne and I were talking about this morning. You know, in 30 plus years, you know, James Hansen in Congress in 87, I mean, but you go back to the early 80s, the moral argument on climate change and the scientific argument hasn't been enough. So what is going to be enough?
Yeah, I mean, the moral argument, as you point out, is incredibly powerful. The scientific literature is absolutely compelling, and yet it hasn't worked in decades. And so that's where I think that, you know, we need to keep encouraging folks in their daily life to make the changes, make smart choices. But the most important thing that all of the listeners can do is get involved in governing, vote. And because until our policymakers are actually working on the behalf of us and not on the behalf of the fossil fuel companies, we're not going to get the policy environment that's going to allow entrepreneurs and investors to have the confidence that they can make massive investments in long-term infrastructure to make the transition to get us away from these dirty, dangerous energy sources.
Professor Hettinger, you had a smile on your face there when she was saying the most important thing we can do. Why?
Yeah, so, I mean, with climate change, it's basically a collective action problem that, you know, dealing with climate change is something that imposes costs on whoever does the dealing, and the benefits go to everybody worldwide, and mostly into the future, too. So for people that, if some people think that, well, we can deal with climate change if everyone just kind of makes a few personal choices here and there, but that's unlikely to get us, first of all, contributions from everyone, but second of all, enough contributions overall. It's sort of like if we told everyone, taxes are now voluntary. You can pay taxes if you like to, right? I think we can agree that even if we had some sort of taboo on not paying taxes and we convinced most people that they should pay some taxes, it probably wouldn't quite bring in enough money to keep governments running. And climate change is the same type of problem, that the contributions of a few small people can help, and it can show leadership and show that things are achievable, but it's not going to solve the problem on its own.
Okay, Sue?
Well, the primary failure of the environmental movement has been to say, look, we just need individuals to take the right moral action. And why? Because we have systems that are driving us to make other choices. So it's the system that has to change, and then the individuals within that system can either make benign choices or good choices or whatever. But if two-thirds of my carbon footprint is not my direct consumption of energy, even when I do all the right things in my house, in my electric car, in my biking or whatever, I'm not accounting for the other two-thirds. That's only going to happen when we have the entire system changing with me, and that has to be a policy level decision. It has to have a stable decision so that you have people investing in wind and solar on the long term and discouraging the construction of fossil fuel infrastructure, right? And all of the above energy policy was a disaster. That just means more of the same with a little of something else thrown in. We have to decide as a society that we have to walk away from fossil fuels. And that's a politically challenging decision to make, given all the money that's in it. But that's the reality.
But not if this becomes, as former Congressman Bob Inglis said on this program, it's easier if it becomes a question of there's still a lot of money to be made here.
Sure. You know,
because sometimes it's presented as this choice. Mm-hmm. You know, do you want this lucrative fossil fuel industry, or do you want economic desolation, but at least the species survives? It's like it's a one or the other.
Exactly.
Which is mostly, mm-hmm. from best I can tell, from people far smarter and mm-hmm. well-researched than I am,
right.
Baloney.
Right. Sure. Well, yeah. And our continued dependence on fossil fuels is rife with all kinds of other problems. You want less health care expense, well, then let's have less air pollution, right? So there's many benefits for our entire society to gain economically and is in our health by shifting away from fossil fuels. So, but again, it's this challenge of bringing in the externalized benefits. Everybody's going to benefit, and yet we have privatized, our system privatizes all the investment choices, right? So you have private investors who reap profits by externalizing costs, and society's bearing those costs, and now we want society to get the benefits. Well, how does that happen? It happens through policy.
Okay. Tim, you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. It's clear that the nature of the issue is radically systemic, like in each of these areas that we're talking about, so economic, political, cultural, and that the nature of the solutions is fundamentally systemic and political. But at a deeper level, it's also fundamentally personal. So, you know, it just brings me to a place of the process of people becoming open to looking at what's happening. And how does that begin? Well, how does climate change affect people individually? How does it affect them personally? How does it affect members of their family or people they know? And, you know, in terms of what Catherine Hayhoe was saying, what do they care about? What do we care about as people? We care about our families. We care about children. We care about, you know, we care about nature. How are these things in our own lives being impacted by what is happening now and what is going to be happening even more so in the future? So it becomes a process of opening and reflecting and talking about this and then beginning to learn. And then beginning to connect with community members, and then becoming active politically, but it's not all, you know, instantly. The solutions are fundamentally systemic, but the changes, even on an individual systemic lifestyle level, are individual and kind of family and community in origin. So it's a both and.
I have in a moment. I want to pivot to at least a question I have, because a number of people on this email thread that I sent out over the weekend, just kind of talking about ideas about this, scolded me a little bit for being too negative about, you know, the sacrifices we must make. And they're going, do you know the worst way to sell a climate change prescription is to caution people about sacrifice? But I want to see if realistically we have to at least address that. Or I think, you know, I think the point that I'm getting here, at least from this panel, is when we talk about individual sacrifice, it misses the point of the power dynamics of what is driving policy.
Sure.
And what has sort of dominated that. So, Suzanne Hunt, let me just do a couple of things here, because you're the first one who raised this. Number one, where are we going to make the money in alternatives, and why in Washington hasn't this picked up enough steam? You've worked in Washington. You worked in Washington for how long?
12 years.
12 years. Why then? You've been in these private meetings where members of Congress have told you, you're right, I agree with all this politically, I can't do it. Why isn't there sort of an equal power in the alternatives that have kind of gone up to push back?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things to consider is momentum and the fact that we've been, you know, society has been powered by these fossil fuels for well over a century. And so the amount of, for example, hidden subsidies, the amount of cultural, the norms that are woven into all aspects of society, policy, politics, law, it takes a massive effort to unravel some of that and to transform it. And the high tech, clean tech sectors are starting to do this. There's a group called Climate Hawks that is backing a bunch of candidates that will commit to not taking fossil fuel money, and they're 4-for-4 so far in the primary so far. So there's definitely a lot of work being done to push against, you know, this. The existing power structures, it's just so hard. So part of it is that it's so hard to fight against the system now. One of the things that the author did was lay it out. She said, you know, with Citizens United now, the fossil fuel companies can spend as much as they want on these races.
That's right.
So the dynamic we already mentioned is just even worse. You know, the other thing to keep in mind, so campaign finance is like the number one thing on anyone who's running for office's mind out of necessity. It's not a criticism, it's just the way it is right now. So that's one thing. But then think about the number one word you hear out of every politician's mouth. What would it be?
Jobs,
exactly. Jobs. It's usually jobs. What are the number one and number two fastest growing jobs in America right now by far? Blowing everyone away.
Solar and wind.
Solar installation and wind turbine technology.
Technician,
thank you. Does anyone know that in the public? Do any politicians talk about that? So this is what we're up against. And in that Twitter feed, really, she did a good job laying it out.
Okay, Tim?
I'd just like to build on that word momentum and really shift the ground a little bit and talk about solutions. Because there is an enormous amount happening on all kinds of levels in terms of solutions. So just beginning, locally, the work of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and their three issues, that Sue can speak to. There's our group in terms of citizen policy involvement through Citizen Climate Lobby for a price on carbon. And there is a project called Drawdown, with that's been authored by Paul Hawken, and that is the result of research over the last 5 years of 225 scientists and innovators, experts from around the world that have measured, mapped, and modeled solutions to global warming that we, on an individual level, can engage. So the whole thing here is that the solutions already exist on practical, technical, scientific, engineering levels, and we know what they are in terms of price and carbon on policy levels. So part of it is just this whole process of acknowledging and joining as people get into it and start caring more. The already existing energy and momentum towards solutions on a range of levels, and it's just wide open at this point.
I want to turn it over to our listeners. I want to appeal to you directly. Are you optimist that in our lifetimes, whatever that is for you, that we're going to see a real move to eliminate the use of fossil fuels? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I've got some emails that are already in, some from optimists, some from dire pessimists. And before we go on, I want the panel to either affirm or punish me for thinking in my brain, I think, well, we just have to be adults now. Maybe we need to live in smaller houses. Maybe we shouldn't be able to drive cars. We have to be adults. Oh, you just hung your head, Suzanne. Huh? You think this is the worst thing we could be doing. And so take me out of this mindset, because again, this mindset seems to drive a lot of people in your lines of work nuts, because it does turn people off. I understand that. So why does it drive you crazy?
Because I'm constantly searching for solutions, and rather than, you know, I want to put our time and energy and money into what works. And we have decades of experience discovering that telling people to self-sacrifice to save the planet doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. Whereas if you say, I have this phenomenal electric car, it's gorgeous, it's a better experience, it's a better value proposition, people will switch. So, and it's much more exciting. I love getting together with, who doesn't love getting together with innovators, problem solvers that are making your life better and more interesting and rich, than saying, you know, turn down your thermostat, you know, be slightly cold all the time. You know, no one wants to think that way. We can, you know, we're smarter than that. We can solve the problems. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we can be opulent in our lifestyle. You know, one of the sayings that I think really makes sense here is that there's enough resources on the planet for everyone's needs, but not everyone's greed. Mm-hmm. And so it's a combination of both. But in terms of inspiring and changing the discussion, it's all about innovating to make our lives better.
I take the point, and I am going to shift, because number one, you're right, it doesn't work. But number two, who knows what the size of our dwellings or how we're going to be getting around. We may be loving our transportation options in the future.
Look at tiny houses. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've taken off.
They're actually really cool.
Yeah.
But honestly, we may be loving our transportation options once we just let innovators get unleashed here, because that's actually, as Inglis and others have said, a very, in this country, sort of our paradigm, that's a conservative ideal. Unleash the free market. Unleash innovation. So, okay. So I'm off that track. You've pushed me off that, all of you. So congratulations to you. We're going to be optimists, and we'll start taking calls in a second here. When it comes to public policy, on the, you know, so sort of your side as an academic, you've looked a lot about how policy moves in different circles. Do you agree with what you're hearing from your co-panelists here, that there is possible policy that comes out of sort of refocusing onto innovation, not sort of a draconian, just a penalty for certain types of energy, but also incentivizing new innovation?
Yeah, certainly. And in fact, I wouldn't necessarily distinguish those. If you, for example, put a price on carbon, you're going to get an awful lot of innovation. So those aren't necessarily different policies.
Draconian was the wrong word. Yeah. Go ahead.
But you know, anything that tries to restrict the amount of carbon that's being put out, or change the way that we're consuming energy, or change the way that industry produces energy, is going to indirectly drive innovation. But you know, I think overall, you know, the climate change problem, I don't like to sell it as something that's going to appear to be less expensive than the status quo, because I think actually directly, at least in the near term, it's going to look a little bit more expensive. But we have the technologies that exist now or are soon on their way. And if we use policy to demand their application, we can vastly reduce our carbon emissions while increasing costs just a tad directly. But of course, the indirect benefits vastly outweigh the small costs. And a lot of the near-term costs are more due to the systemic change, you know, the sunk cost problem that we have an invested infrastructure based on fossil fuels that we'll have to some degree, tear out and replace with a cleaner version.
All right, phone calls in a second. You want to jump on that, Tim?
Just really quickly. There does seem to be emerging a consensus on the need for pricing carbon, and even within the Republican Party. So at this point in time, there is a House bipartisan Climate Solution Caucus has 38 Republicans and 38 Democrats in what might be, I'm not sure, but the largest caucus in the House. It's basically where climate policy is going to come from in the House. So there's an emerging consensus that something like that is needed, along with all of these other pieces. But to Eric's point about the price, our proposal, the carbon fee and dividend proposal, has the dividend from the tax, from the fee on fossil fuels at the source point, not the gas stations, but at the source point, going to all American households on an equal basis, so that people have the money to pay for the increase in the cost of not only fossil fuels, but across the economy as it scaled up. So again, this is our proposal, but these are all integrated in a policy intention in Washington.
You're going to hear it come up a bit. If you want to learn more about carbon fee and dividend, where would you send people, Tim?
CitizensClimateLobby.org.
CitizensClimateLobby.org. Yeah. Suzanne Hunt?
Just really quickly, Eric mentioned often the investments are more expensive up front. And the other half of that is then often there's big savings over time. And so part of why we need policy leadership and government leadership on this is so that investors have the confidence to make the upfront investments so that we can all earn from that over time and earn and be better off, and then also avoid the huge costs that we're incurring and with the increasingly extreme, increasingly common weather that we're experiencing.
Okay. And I would like to add that we have an opportunity locally for our local communities to play a role here. The New York State is trying very hard to create policies that allow us to make different decisions. So community choice aggregation has been allowed. It means whole municipalities can aggregate their energy demands for residents and small businesses and go to bid together. Westchester County piloted this, and they have 14 communities purchasing 100% renewable energy. In March, the Public Service Commission said, hey, you are allowed to incorporate the shared solar directly into these programs. So our towns could be passing a local law and hiring an administrator who is committed to 100% renewable energy, and their residents could be saving money through guaranteed savings from the shared solar. And the reason why it's so crucial is because right now the investors are hesitant to build large solar fields because they don't know who the buyers are going to be. But our towns can guarantee that market to them. And I've spent 3 years working on this policy. We got a handful of towns who have passed the local law, and there are some really big players like Penfield and Irondequoit and Pittsford and Brighton who have said, called on Congress, congratulations to CCL, to put a price on carbon, but they could do something more locally. They could commit to 100% renewable community choice aggregation programs.
By the way, Suzanne Hunt, having worked in Washington, do you have confidence in this bipartisan congressional caucus, 38 Republicans, 38 Democrats, are they sincere about it from what you can tell?
It depends. And to be clear, I never worked on the Hill. I just couldn't make myself do it. So I worked around I worked around politics for all that time. My guess is that many of the Republicans are about to retire. I should know these numbers, but I think a lot of the Republicans that have joined
there are some
are
so it's less politically risky for them to do this.
Yeah, because they're not running again, and
that's a problem.
And I don't mean to take away from all the good work, and I do think that these kinds of things help, but voters need to be much more active and much more vocal, because if you look at all of the polls, the vast majority of Americans are concerned about climate change. And so if we didn't have money in politics, we would have climate policy by now.
Exactly.
That is probably the best distillation of where we are in this panel. All right. So, Jack, Gloria on the phones, we're coming to you. Richard, got a number of emails to read. Let's get our only break of the hour. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about practical solutions as we take a look at actually getting off of fossil fuels as a society. Getting it done, what are the barriers preventing that now? What do we do about those barriers? Because those solutions are within our grasp if we choose them. You just heard Suzanne Hunt, founder of Hunt Green LLC and director of strategic development at Hunt Country Vineyards. Sue Hughes Smith is co-founder of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Tim McGowan, founding member of the Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester is the name of the organization. Professor Eric Hittinger, who is an associate professor of public policy at RIT. Your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we're joined by legendary actor and comedian John Cleese. He'll be in Rochester next month for a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He'll join us to discuss his career and the impact Monty Python has had on the development of comedy as a genre. In our second hour, an expert in Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia says there are a number of misconceptions about these conditions, and that people can live well with these diagnoses. Talk with you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To your phone calls we go. If you're on the line, be patient. We've got a lot to get through, a lot of great feedback this hour. Jack in Rochester first. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, Evan. I agree with what the panel said, that the problems are primarily systemic. I think carbon pricing makes a good deal of sense. However, that's going to be a lot of political lift to make that happen. It's in the works, and I think it's coming. However, you know, with all the money involved from big oil, in particular, the PR, the political power and investment from big oil, I think it's really economics that are going to drive this, and carbon pricing is part of that. Some of the good news is there are a lot of technical solutions that are finally being brought to market globally. As you know, locally, I'm at Sweetwater Energy. We've been around for over a decade, and we spun out of RIT, but we're finally bringing a commercial scale solution to market globally. We're building in Europe, and we actually take carbon from wood and from crop residues, that carbon that's been in the atmosphere over the last 20 years, and are making it now in a form that is able to compete economically with petroleum. So the plastics, fuels, really well beyond even into paper products and so forth, and even food products, as incredible as that may seem, we're actually making those with partners now. So the renewables and companies like ours are actually coming out, and we can compete all the way down to under $40 a barrel oil. And once that reality begins hitting the markets for everyone in terms of what they can put into their own pockets and for corporations, that is going to really turn the tide, I think, globally in terms of where this revolution is going to happen. It has to be, I think, in people's pockets first.
Jack, can I just ask you one quick follow-up? I was at a dinner party last night, and a very nice guy at the party was kind of ranting about a number of issues related to climate change, not the least of which is, he says, well, all alternative energy needs subsidy. So, and I said, do you really want to make the argument that fossil fuels are not subsidized? It's just about the most subsidized things. I think subsidy is probably a Latin word that actually means oil. I don't know, but Jack, and for listeners who think I'm being too snarky, let me make an offer to any listener who wants a little bit of documentation or information on that, because I spent some time last night after the dinner party looking it up. I'm happy to send you materials on subsidy. But for you, Jack, working in this industry, how do you feel when people say, well, if you need subsidy in the alternative energy world, you know, how come you're not making it on the free market? You want to address that as well and take the snark out of me? I'll let you, from your perspective, handle that as well.
Sure. Well, I agree with you. And we are actually coming to market without subsidy. So that's been part of the key. For the longest time, we were trying to build really a business model that did rely on RINs, you know, for fuels on that side of the equation, because we've got a lot of products that this technology brings to market. But when oil plummeted from over $100 a barrel down into the 40s and even below, we decided to recast and focus on, okay, we have to get the technology better. We have to become more efficient. The process really has to improve, and we have to be able to compete with oil at $40 a barrel. And that's what we did. And we had a lot of good people around the world helping us do that. So as we come to market, we're actually able to compete with really low-cost oil. The renewables, of course, the large issue is storage and batteries, and there's great work going on in that regard. So I think, to your point on subsidies, absolutely. Big oil is hugely subsidized in this country and around the world. But I really do believe that because of the political muscle on the side of big oil, getting out there economically, where we actually are bringing technologies to market that don't rely on subsidies, will begin to level the playing field.
Jack, send me an email separately, because we haven't talked as much as I'd like. I'd like to learn more about what you're doing. But thanks for taking the time to call the program.
Thanks, Evan. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jack. 844-295-TALK. We've got a lot of phone lines lit up here. Before I jump to the next caller here, anybody else want to add to what they heard from Jack there? Professor?
Yeah, so I guess obviously the best thing for climate change would be if new technologies came in and they could just outcompete the old technologies, push them out. We don't need to do anything, and we have low carbon emissions.
It's a pure free market.
Free market.
Right.
Yeah. We win. However, right, we're already behind on this problem. And a lot of people are very excited about new technologies, and they should be, because they're getting better and cheaper all the time. But I want to point out that that's not a good excuse for not having policy to support this, because if you try to leave it to the free market, you're always going to have these new technologies at a disadvantage. They're always going to be slower deployment than they should be. And as you pointed out, fossil fuels already get a lot of subsidies. And maybe the most important subsidy that fossil fuels get isn't a direct monetary one. It's that they get to pollute for free, basically.
Yeah, I would I would also add that there are huge barriers to entry to a lot of these markets. So, you know, you look at, you know, new fuels for airplanes, the amount, the cost of the testing and the time. If you look at the power sector, it's highly regulated. You can't just
create. It's not a free market.
It's not a free market. It's one of the most highly regulated, controlled markets you can imagine. So, I've been saying innovation the whole show, but you have to understand the markets that you're trying to enter and what all the barriers are.
What can we do about that?
I hate to keep hammering the same point, but we really have to push policymakers. So
sure.
In the power sector, the Public Service Commission in New York State right now has a whole lot of power to help. And there are processes underway that are trying to change these things, but I hate to pick on utilities, but I'm going to. They're not here to defend themselves. You know, the utilities are really slowing down this transition process that's underway in New York. And I think that people have to pressure the policymakers and the public service commissioners to to speed this along as best they can.
Well, and 40% of our greenhouse gases in New York State come from transportation. All right, so the fact that the governor is committing to electric charging stations all along the thruway is a fantastic thing. I'd love to be able to go further in an electric car, and I think people who buy electric cars love them, and that's going to help us transition. But people aren't going to just magically make those all on their own, right? Policies will lead to those installations.
Jessica on Twitter says policies on fossil fuels won't change until we change the fossils making policy.
Yeah, I mean,
we need like a cymbal smash for a good final act.
Yeah, and I think some of it just involves more effort. I mean, to change systems takes more work. So if we need to staff up some of the agencies more, if we need to provide external support to these policymakers, you know, that should be done as well, because their job's already hard. Now we're adding this historic energy transition on top of their already difficult day job. So we should also be willing to put that kind of support in place.
Tim, I just want to make a point in regard to what we're talking about, what Eric was speaking to specifically, and that is that the innovations in technology and in policy enhance each other. They feed each other. So this person I mentioned, Paul Hawken, with this Project Drawdown, was asked when he presented the 100 Solutions to Reversing Global Warming to a national call of the Citizens Climate Lobby. He was asked, well, what do you think about the policy dimension as a solution to climate change? And he said that, for instance, the carbon fee and dividend would only enhance the energy in innovation. In other words, our proposal would free up capital to invest in innovation. And simply the point that it's not antithetical, clearly, technology and policy, but that innovations across the board are going to be synergistic, are going to be multiplier, creatively enhancing the full system dynamic.
And there will still be people getting rich even when fossil fuels are left in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back to your phone calls, and we're going to try to keep it moving. Edgar in Naples next. Go ahead, Edgar.
Hey, Evan, thanks for taking my call. I think you have a great panel today, and I want to shout out to Tim and Suzanne especially, because I think they're doing a great job at raising awareness and educating the public. I want to respond to your question about, am I confident in the future in my lifetime? And I'm usually an eternal optimist, but no, I'm not confident now, because Suzanne and others have already mentioned that, in my opinion, I think we have the best politicians that money can buy. And so as long as, politicians and policymakers are not working for the people, I think it's going to take a long time. The only thing that we're lacking to make those kinds of changes that we're all talking about is political will. And so the technology is there, but the policy is just not catching up to that. So I'm really afraid for my kids and my grandkids. It's not going to be us. It's going to be the next few generations.
All right, Edgar, thank you. He invoked Suzanne Hunt, so I'll turn it back to you. Two things here. You can try to combat this issue of the influence of money in politics and the status quo for fossil fuels having the advantages by doing, as far as I can tell, two things. You could elect people who are not going to pass policy that favors fossil fuels, or you can try to really change the entire system of money in politics. My guess is you'd like to do both, but what's more realistic, and where's the emphasis you think for the average citizen supposed to be on this?
Well, I want to just to give the caller a little bit of hope. I think we have to keep in mind some of these other examples. So we talked about the cell phone example. We talked about the transition from horse and buggy to cars. But if you look at something like smoking and how fast it became, it went from the every actor on every top movie was smoking constantly throughout the movie, and it was just the cultural norm, and that's what you wanted to do when you were a teenager to be cool, to now it's not only culturally unacceptable, now policies are changing so that you physically can't smoke in public spaces. So there's a change. I think we have this kind of built-in kind of assumption, unconscious assumption, that change happens gradually. But really, what happens is change happens incredibly fast. And so we just need to get to the tipping point of public pressure to get to the to these rapid changes that are going to make the future better for the callers.
And there are economic changes that are happening. Iowa's getting 30% of their electricity from wind. They're not raving lefties out there. There's a coal-fired electric utility in Colorado that is going to close because wind and solar new are more competitive for them, right? So there are a lot of good signs, but we could enhance all these changes through policy. Yeah.
Okay. Texas is the biggest wind state in the country.
Exactly.
Professor?
Yeah, I was going to add, in response to what the caller mentioned about the best politicians money can buy, one of the other issues that we haven't even talked about with climate change is what policy people call an asymmetry of interest, that it turns out the people that want to deal with climate change is all of us, a little tiny bit, although some of us more than others. The people that want to continue with the status quo tend to be very concentrated and tend to have lots and lots of money at stake, billions or trillions of dollars. So in these types of situations, it tends to be that the handful of people with an intense interest in one option tend to win out, because for everyone else, it's the seventh or eighth or 12th most important thing on their mind. But if it's the most important thing on your mind and you are a big fossil fuel company, you're going to be throwing around millions or billions of dollars to maintain.
So more of us need to make more phone calls to our local and national officials.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Move it up your list.
Yeah.
Politicians don't create political will. They respond to it. That's a mantra for CCL. So absolutely. Cards and letters and protests and meetings and the whole deal, holding nothing back. I just want to affirm just on this point about wealth and the use of wealth in terms of climate policy. So we're clear on what we just have been talking about in terms of individual wealth. But I want to point out another encouraging dimension, and that is the whole divestment campaign. So, for instance, 350.org has, at this point, 880 institutions that have committed to divesting from fossil fuel companies to the tune of $6 trillion. 880 institutions at $6 trillion. So that's a lot of money. And so that's mostly institutions. That's a lot of pension funds, et cetera. But we're talking about capital. We're talking about massive amounts of money that are consciously being withdrawn from the fossil fuel sector to give a message, to say we need to move to clean energies as soon as possible. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, has been leading a global campaign for mayors on how to develop more sustainable city, governments and infrastructure. And he recently committed to $4.5 million to the Paris summit in lieu of President Trump withdrawing from Paris. So there's another use of real capital in terms of how it can be used favorably.
All right, back to the phones. We got to keep it moving. Robert in Fairport. Next up, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think that the problem here is that I'm going to inject some reality in the conversation, is that the technology isn't even close to transition away from fossil fuels. And I'm going to cite an example from Andrew Cuomo, who is trying to shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant, which I think is based in Westchester, in 2020 or 2021. The power that's going to come to replace the power that was produced by this nuclear power plant is going to come from three gas-fired power plants. So you got a situation where New York City, when you turn the lights on, they're going to be powered by frack gas from other states, fossil fuel. So I'm kind of curious as to why Andy Cuomo didn't get out there and put some solar power plants out there, or wind power plants or something like that, to replace this nuclear power plant.
So, Robert, I'm going to let our guest respond to that, but I'm curious to know why you are so pessimistic about the power of innovation and the entrepreneurs out there who could unleash that spirit if we actually prioritize it. Why are you a pessimist?
because these power plants cost millions upon millions of dollars to run and most likely be running for between the next probably 30 to 60 years.
All right. Thank you, Robert, for the phone call on the subject of what the governor's.
So, thank you, Robert. I'm not a big fan of Cuomo's political decision either. It's not a technological decision. It's a political decision. We could just as easily, and we probably should be, pursuing offshore wind. It's like the Saudi Arabia of wind off the coast of Long Island. And we could be having jobs building those wind turbines right down in that area and shipping them out and putting them into the ocean and then supplying that energy to New York City where it's so badly needed. So it's a political decision that Cuomo made, not a technological one.
Yeah, I just want to clear up a little. There's a little confusion, I think, in the question. So the government doesn't put up power plants and power arrays. That's what the private sector does. The government just determines the rules for those actors. The other piece of confusion is it's not that the technology isn't ready. It's that these technologies haven't been built out yet. And they haven't been built out yet for all the reasons we've been talking about for almost an hour now. So just wanted to clear those two things. But the caller does raise the point that we need what we were saying. We need a climate policy for New York State so that investors have the confidence to make these big long-term investments.
Okay, but let's hammer that point one more time, because Robert is challenging the idea that we have enough scalable new technology to literally replace gas stations and our oil usage. And you're saying...
But this is why we talk about this as a transition. It doesn't happen overnight, but it can happen over a decade if we have the structures in place so that the innovators and private sector can move quickly, like they have done over and over and over again when there's a clear directive.
Okay. It is doable and probably faster than we think, but it requires a lot of will and priority. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the nice things, we live in Rochester, New York, which is the cleanest electricity grid in the country. It's basically, it's for all intents and purposes, decarbonized here. Now, we have a few things going for us, like a lot of great hydro resources that not everywhere has. But clearly, we've shown in this upstate New York region that you can basically decarbonize with existing technologies. Or, for example, an upper ceiling on the cost of decarbonization would be to build a ton of nuclear power plants all over the country. Now, probably renewables will come in cheaper than that, but that's an existing technology that produces no carbon, and we use it all across the U.S. and around the world.
Okay, Tim, keep it tight.
Yeah, just on the level of state policy and climate change, I just want to mention one group. It's called New York Renews, and their foci currently are on two pieces of legislation. One is called the Climate and Community Protection Act, and the other is called the Just Transition and Polluter Fee. So if people are interested more in getting into state-level climate change policy advocacy, www.newyorkrenews.org is a good site and source.
newyorkrenews.org. All right, let me grab in. It's got to be tight. Gloria in Canandaigua, 30 seconds. Go ahead, Gloria.
Okay, I want to tell you, and I want to tell you about a wonderful organization that has been around since 1982 and has been working on renewables, Rocky Mountain Institute. It's doing and has been doing wonderful things. Also, I just want to state that in Rochester, there's also solar farms starting to open, which I'm very happy about. And a quote from the Rocky Mountain Institute magazine, the spring magazine, is, "We believe that success in the vital effort depends on individuals and markets, not on policymakers and government alone." I think that policymakers follow the individuals and the organizations that are already doing good things.
All right, Gloria, thank you. By the way, I think I saw my son and I were out, I think, Long Acre Farms in Macedon, if that's where it is, has a big solar array. Every time we see a solar array, we're always honking and doing thumbs up. I think they look great. We are seeing more of that. I'm with you there. I didn't know about Rocky Mountain Institute. Should I, everyone? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah?
Yep. Yeah. Henry Levins.
Thank you, Gloria. Richard writes to the program and says, "We are looking to build a home in the Rochester area. Almost without exception, the various towns have minimum home sizes, all of which are larger than we want to build, and tiny houses are outlawed just about everywhere. It's very frustrating." That's for Richard.
Well, build a passive house, whatever the size of it is.
Okay. And then the last one, real quick, Darcy wants to know, what does the panel feel about solar farms built by out-of-the-area companies? We've got a lot of farmland and have been approached with an offer by a company who would like to rent our land. That's a lot of experience in your area. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there have to be guidelines put in place. And just because it's solar doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. It has to be done well.
Okay. So here we are after an hour. And the takeaway, I think, tell me if I'm right here, is that the biggest barrier to getting off of fossil fuels is not that it's impossible or we don't have the infrastructure that we could put in place, we don't have the technology. It's that we have prioritized the status quo driven by a system where money is power and a lot of the money is on the side of the fossil fuels. I mean, it's pretty simple, but if we want to make these changes, they're within our grasp. They are. We do not have to be pessimists about it. It's doable. I think about my son. I think about next generations. I do worry like a lot of people, but this panel has made me an optimist today. Way more of an optimist. I got rid of my old campaign slogan for when I run for Congress, which I will never do, which is that I promise to outlaw steak. You have to cut your house size in half, and you will never be able to drive a car. And we'll solve climate change.
I was believing you there for a minute, and you totally, I don't buy that at all.
No, it just doesn't sell. But it turns out we don't have to necessarily do that either. What we can do is unleash the innovation and the wonderful powers that are out there to compete and
no,
change.
No, it's the running for Congress part that
no.
I don't believe.
Oh, you don't think I? Never. Oh, boy. I want to thank our panelists for being here because they all came in and with sort of these disparate backgrounds and had a wonderful conversation that have left me much more of an optimist. So our thanks to Professor Eric Hittinger at RIT. Thank you, Professor. Thanks for being here.
Yep, thanks.
Sue Hughes-Smith, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. You can look them up online. Sue, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
And you can also look up the Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester, Tim McGowan. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Evan. Great.
And Suzanne Hunt, founder of Hunt Green LLC and director of strategic development. Well, you will find her at Hunt Country Vineyards on Cuca Lake. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Tim George, engineer, Megan Mac producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow.